Hello and welcome to the third episode of Satoshi's Mind, brought to you by Nakamoto. On Satoshi's Mind, we discuss recent trends in the blockchain, DLT, and the Web3 space, and some of the applications in other industries with experts that are working on those ideas. My name is Florian, and yeah, I've been in blockchain since 2013, co-founded Nakamoto, which got then integrated in Advanced Blockchain AG. And with Advanced Blockchain AG and Nakamoto, we're like investing in some tokens and companies, and also venture building some of our own ideas. And yeah, here's my co-host Connor.
Hello, thanks, Florian. I'm Connor Kvyacin. I'm a comedian, audio person, and newcomer to the blockchain, DLT, and Web3 space. I'm here to be myself and ask the questions people, especially newcomers like me, might have. What's going on with you, Florian?
Yeah, I've been like pretty busy last couple of days, weeks, working on like a couple of different projects, like mainly like in the lending space, like a DeFi thing we've been like looking into, and a crowdfunding project I've been working on for a while. Also, I'm trying to come to the US pretty soon, for which I need to be outside of Europe. So yeah, I'm going to be in Dubai soon, waiting for the time out of Europe to end so they let me enter the US.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, who do we have on today? Who's our guest?
Our guest is Richard Malone. And yeah, he's done a lot in the Web3 and DLT space, including time he spent as a staff writer for Coin Central. But now he's an investor and he's head of digital assets with Emergence at Wield & Co. and is a director at Ascender Ventures. Yeah, and you can find him on LinkedIn at Richard Malone. Welcome to Satoshi's Mind, Richard.
Thank you, Florian and Connor. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Likewise.
Yeah, great to have you. To like jump into it, like how did you get involved in the whole like blockchain field, and yeah, what got you interested in it?
Yeah, sure. So how I got into the blockchain space is kind of a convoluted path I took to get to where I am today. So actually, I started my career as an analyst for the John Bolton PAC, which is essentially a political action committee that's started by the former ambassador and former national security advisor to the Donald Trump administration, a guy by the name of John Bolton, where I essentially helped him pick out candidates for Congress, both Senate and congressmen and women, that were really all about backing very strong foreign policy and national security initiatives. I realized at that point that although politics was fun, I liked technology a lot more and investing, because my background is in investing. And, you know, I've just always been fascinated with technology and innovation. So I ended up leaving that after a while and went to Draper University, which is an entrepreneur accelerator program in the Draper Ventures ecosystem, where, you know, Tim Draper, who's the founder of Draper University, is a really big Bitcoin guy. So that was kind of my first real exposure. I'd heard about Bitcoin, but knew absolutely nothing about it. So him being probably one of the most recognizable Bitcoin bulls in the space, he basically ingrained it into us from day one that Bitcoin and blockchain was going to change the world, change how governments act, change how people transact with each other, change how people invest. So I definitely bought into the whole notion that blockchain technology was super fascinating. But being a value investor by heart, I actually thought that Bitcoin was kind of BS, to be honest with you. I thought it had no intrinsic value to it, but I thought, okay, that blockchain stuff is cool. But fast forward a little bit, you know, I did my own tech startup. I raised capital for that, did that for about a year, but then realized that the company was probably not going to work, and found my way actually to a cryptocurrency hedge fund. They actually reached out to me to invest in the fund. But at that point, I was looking for a new opportunity. So I said, hey, you know, I may not invest in the fund, although I ultimately ended up investing a little bit into it. But I'd actually be very interested in learning more about the blockchain and cryptocurrency space. So I essentially joined them and was there for close to a year. And that's how I kind of got my feet wet with the blockchain and crypto space. But roughly around the same time that I joined them, you know, Florian, you mentioned I was a staff writer at Coin Central. Thought it was a really good way to augment my education while also kind of being onboarded into this fund. Innovating Capital is the name of the fund. So I started to write, and I was primarily in the news and interview space. So I interviewed a bunch of awesome people, such as the founder of Gnosis, a guy by the name of Stefan George. Interviewed Andrew Keys, who was the head of business development at Consensus, and a bunch of other big people in the space. So kind of got into it from that standpoint. And really my first thing I thought was interesting about blockchain at the token level was Ethereum. I thought that it was a way more smarter asset than Bitcoin, which didn't really have any utility. So I kind of still carried over that sentiment that I got at Draper University. So I thought Ethereum was really cool. Decentralization was really cool. And it was going to change multiple industries and the way that people transact. So that's kind of how I got my feet wet. But over time, I mean, my idea and my thoughts around Bitcoin specifically have changed drastically. We might get into that later, but not to go down too far this rabbit hole right now. But that's essentially how I got my feet wet in the crypto and blockchain space. And have been a believer, a massive believer ever since. Couldn't find myself doing anything else in my career.
You had mentioned too about Coin Central that it helped augment your education. What'd you learn there, and what are like some of the differences from being an investor as you are now with being a fly on the wall and more objective learner as a journalist?
Yeah, I mean, so that's a really good question. I mean, I think so. For example, when I was at the fund, I think that. You know, one thing that you do as an associate at any fund, or even for my own investing purposes at Ascender Venture, which, you know, we may get into later, but, you know, it's really, about doing something called due diligence, right? You really figure out, is this company going to be legit? Is the space that they're innovating in going to be legit? So it's really about doing heavy and thorough research, right? I think that being a staff writer at Coin Central was really enlightening because, you know, you speak with your editor and they say, you know, hey, Richard, this happened in the news this morning. Can you get something out to us by, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock so we can post it on our website? And it kind of forces you to, in a very expedited way, learn a lot about a subject, right? Because it's not just like pulling up a news article, something relevant. Like, for example, we can use PayPal, you know, how they just started offering Bitcoin services. That's obviously something that happened recently, and I was at Coin Central 2 years ago. But just as an example, it kind of forces you to learn all about not just the services that PayPal is offering, but all about the company as well. So you can really come with a robust understanding of the news article, write about it so that you're educating yourself in the beginning, but then afterwards, you're actually educating the people that are consuming the article that you write. So I think that's, from that standpoint, it kind of forces you to be an expert in a very short period of time about different subjects. So I kind of almost use that. I mean, of course, like, you know, you get paid, you get compensated for being a writer there. But I think what was way more rewarding for me was actually the ability to really expedite the entire education process by being kind of forced entrenchment into each of these different subjects, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. My background's in journalism. So that's how... Someone always said, you're basically making yourself an expert in a subject very quickly. You need to be an expert to feel like you have the authority to talk about something or to write about something totally. And share it with an audience.
Totally.
Yeah. Now, with like Wheel and Co., what are your current roles at the company and like what's your day-to-day like there?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, I think, look, like during this work from home environment, you know, we started out. So let me back up from the beginning and then I'll kind of ease into what the day-to-day looks like. So we started Emergence, which is a team that exists underneath Wheeld & Co. So Wheeld & Co. is the parent broker dealer in which the Emergence team, which is the company that I started, operates under. So basically back in December of 2019, The founder of Wield & Co. is a gentleman by the name of David Wield. He was the former vice chairman of NASDAQ. He helped write the Jobs Act, which is kind of a monumental piece of legislation that set forth the precedent for all of crowdfunding and Regulation A capital formation. He's been a big believer and a thought leader in the blockchain space for multiple years, but he never really had a mechanism internally in the Wield & Co. ecosystem to capture the value that he was espousing into the market, being a thought leader in tokenization and blockchain and how it relates to the capital markets in the financial services industry. So he approached my partner, Elliot Chun, and said, hey, do you guys want to come on and basically be the digital assets team underneath the Wield & Co. banner? To which Elliot said, that sounds like a great opportunity. And I was his first call to basically start the digital assets team at Emergence. And over the next multiple months, we grew the team from myself and Elliot. We brought in a guy by the name of Jerry and Noman within the first month. And then basically fast forward to today, we have 13, 14 people strong, mostly senior bankers that are on the team. So the company's grown really well, and I think it's a testament to the growth of the entire digital assets ecosystem. So getting back to your question about what the day-to-day is like. So, you know, Emergence is fundamentally an investment banking entity, right? That's so what we really do. So it's, you know, we're an investment banking entity, which obviously is a very, you know, old school concept in the financial services industry, you know, a broker dealer, an investment bank. But the reason why we consider ourselves very innovative and much different than other investment banks is given the fact that we focus almost exclusively on digital assets and blockchain, while 90, 95, maybe even higher percent of broker dealers will not touch this stuff due to the regulatory uncertainty of digital assets and specifically tokens, utility tokens, right? That's obviously kind of the big elephant in the room of trying to understand what utility tokens are and where they fit within the legal framework of the SEC and security law.
For people outside, people like me, can you explain a little bit about utility tokens and what they are at a very high level?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think that, you know, when you take a look at the tokens as an asset, there's really two or three different types. Actually, there's three or four different types of tokens out there. But the two main ones that I think are really important to touch on here are security tokens and utility tokens. A security token is essentially just a digital representation of an asset that we all know. So, you know, today, for example, people know stocks, people know bonds. A security token is essentially just a blockchain-enabled version of those old assets. So that's kind of an old school, more just like very traditional application of blockchain technology. A utility token is something that I believe is much more innovative than a security token, because essentially a utility token is a mechanism whereby people within a specific ecosystem have to acquire and use this token in order to consume or participate in whatever service the underlying platform is offering, right? So I think, you know, for example, we take a look at Ethereum or many of the ERC-20 tokens. They're called a utility token because they have utility in the underlying ecosystem. You have to use that specific token in order to do anything in that ecosystem. So in that sense, you know, a utility token can actually go up and down in value, just like a stock, just like a security token. But it has a specific use case, which is why there's a little bit of an obfuscation around whether it is a security or a utility and actually has a real use case, even though it does have the actual use case, but it goes up and down in value. So the regulators might say, well, you know, it's a security because it goes up and down in value, but it actually also has a use case to it. Hence the kind of difficulty classifying as a security or not. But I know that was a long-winded way of answering, but
it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it really does.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's really also kind of fluid because, like, on the one hand, someone might say, like, hey, we got this utility right here. But then the regulator is like, well, but you're selling a financial instrument that people expect to make money on. So still a security.
Exactly. I mean, I think that that's kind of the crux of it, right? I mean, there's in securities law, I'm blanking on the name of it. I think it's the not the Dewey Decimal System, but in any case, the SEC uses a system where they basically have four characteristics that says, like, if you buy an asset where you expect to make a profit based off of the performance of other people, that essentially makes it a security, right? So like that right there, a utility token can inherently be considered a security because the people that operate the platform will probably, depending on the job that they do and the adoption of the platform, actually increase the value of the underlying token. So that's where things kind of get really tricky. I think Europe and Flow, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but Europe is pretty favorable in their outlook about utility tokens, as in they're pretty lenient, as in they don't necessarily outright classify all utility tokens as securities. While in the United States, that's kind of they're going down the path of maybe classifying at least the vast majority of these utility tokens as securities.
Yeah, I think Europe generally is like maybe you could say sometimes like a little more innovative than the US on like token stuff. For example, like in Germany, which is like on the utility token side, which I guess you can also do in the US, you can get a prospectus for the token and then you can do basically like a public offering for it. If you have like a prospectus that explains like what is it, what are the risks involved? Like that's the important part. How does it work basically? The security token space, especially in Germany, is also pretty interesting right now because there are like new laws coming out, which are actually being brought forward by the government that, basically say that a bunch of assets, including like in the future stocks and bonds and stuff, can now be officially represented by tokens, whereas previously you had to have like some type of contracts or something. And yeah, token is technically also a contract. So now all the big crowdfunding companies in Germany are all jumping into blockchain. Actually, like the two biggest ones are now looking or already offering blockchain solutions.
It feels like one of those times where regulators are catching up to what's actually already happening, which seems, I don't know, it seems like as things advance, it's just kind of the way things go and the way regulatory bodies work. But before we got onto utility token, you were talking about Wield & Co. And I also know you work at Ascender Ventures, and I want to hear a little bit more about that. But I'm also really curious in hearing about, you know, you were investing, where that transition happened. You said you were not on the Bitcoin train when you started, but now you're an investor, which means not only are you interested in it, but you're putting your stake in the ground saying, this is where I am, this is what I believe in. So
yeah,
can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, particularly around Bitcoin, as I mentioned earlier, I used to be a humongous bear. Actually, during the crazy 2017 rally, I was literally, you can look at my Facebook post from 2017. I was begging my friends and family and whoever thought that Bitcoin was a good investment at that point to not buy it. And if it did buy it, sell it immediately, because I knew that it was going to absolutely just crater in value. But that's the nature of bubbles. And in the best assets in the world can get bubbly, right? So at that point in time, I was a huge bear. Fast forward to probably the end of 2018, so about a year later, I became absolutely fascinated with Bitcoin from a completely different perspective. If you take a look at Bitcoin just from pure tech perspective, I don't know if we're allowed to cuss on the show or not, but like it's a really, really piece of shitty technology, right? Like really when it comes down to it, like in terms of the performance itself, conceptually speaking, Bitcoin is an unbelievably brilliant innovation. But when you compare Bitcoin to other blockchain technologies, the performance, the block size of it, the transaction speeds, it's ridiculously slow and inefficient in that sense compared to the vast majority of newer versions of blockchains. So that was kind of the paradigm in which I viewed Bitcoin originally, was that, oh, okay, like it's just the first iteration of a technology that will only consider to get, that'll only just get better and better and better in the future. Now I am way more of the belief that community and adoption is so much more important for the value accrual of any sort of token or coin or cryptocurrency, generally speaking, than the actual underlying technology. So when you say, you know, putting your foot in the ground and I'm an investor in the space, Bitcoin is by far and away my biggest investment in the space. I've made angel investments in the actual equity of companies in the space, but by and large, I think that any astute crypto investor is going to at least have a percentage of their allocation into Bitcoin. And the reason is because there is an incredible macroeconomic quality, or I should say, put differently, that Bitcoin is probably the best macroeconomic hedge to all the fiscal stimulus and money printing policies of the Federal Reserve that I've ever seen. I mean, gold is, of course, like the traditional hedge asset. But I believe that Bitcoin, fundamentally, given its sound money principles and programmable scarcity, and just the adoption and the dramatic uptick in use, it's just going to accrue value over time as people get more and more interested. They start to really appreciate the hard money principles of Bitcoin. There's ever going to only be 21 million ever. There's never going to be any more than 21 million Bitcoin. And programmatically, the supply is cut in half every single 4 years, called the halving, right? Halving or halvening, depending on who you're speaking to. As a result, it just makes perfect sense if you take a look at the economic principle of supply and demand, right? As supply remains flat or decreases and demand increases, you're going to see a massive price appreciation. And I'm of the fundamental belief that, similar to Tim Draper, that probably over the next 5 years, you're going to see Bitcoin at 250K per BTC. So that's kind of my thesis around Bitcoin, is the community, the adoption, and the hard money principles, and just the fervent community behind it that will not sell. They're always going to hodl, as people say in the community, right? They will never sell their Bitcoin. And as a result, it's always going to have strength in numbers, more so than any other crypto in the space. So that's my specific thesis around Bitcoin. I think Ethereum, which is my second biggest holding, also has a lot of utility to it because it's by far and away the most adopted smart contract platform. And if people are believers in decentralization or in the power of smart contracts, then Ethereum is by far your smartest bet. I mean, I think, you know, other people might say, well, you know, Ethereum's performance is pretty crappy on a transaction per second basis. But I think that, again, it kind of goes back to this whole notion of adoption, right? And specifically with Ethereum being the most widely adopted smart contract platform, they have the biggest engineering community in the world, right? Like, all the developers are developing on Solidity, which is the language that's utilized by Ethereum. So as a result, everyone wants to be where everyone's building on, right? So that's kind of my underlying thesis for Ethereum, which are, you know, so Bitcoin, Ethereum, my two biggest holdings. Do you want me to go into some of my other investments, or?
Well, I was circling to Ascender. Is that kind of what you're doing there?
Yeah. So with Ascender specifically, I mean, yeah. So I definitely hold my assets under the Ascender Ventures guys for sure. But I've made, so Ascender Ventures actually started back in 20, it really started in 2016. And actually I made my first couple investments outside of the crypto and blockchain space, because at that point I liked blockchain, but I didn't understand it enough. I made a couple investments in the AI space and in the data analytics space. And that was kind of where I thought a lot of the growth was going to accumulate, was in like kind of those enterprise solutions for data. So that was kind of my thesis originally. As I said, probably towards the end of 2018, beginning of 2019, I shifted the thesis towards investing in blockchain companies. So my first big blockchain investment in the crypto space under the Ascender Ventures banner was a decentralized Oracle service called Teller. Very small team. I met the founder at Fluidity back in 2018. And at that point, I already knew about oracles. Oracles are a pretty like nuanced subject within the field of crypto and blockchain. At a very high level, an oracle is essentially a data bank or a connecting entity that is able to supply real-world information two blockchain ecosystems, because fundamentally, blockchains are separated from the rest of the world. It's its own encompassing ecosystem that needs to use something like an Oracle service in order to take real world data and actually utilize that data for some purposes. So, for example, you know, you take a look at prediction markets, or you take a look at just, you know, betting markets, generally speaking. Let's say we're betting on who's going to win the election here in a couple of days. You need to be able to have an Oracle service which takes real world information and applies it to the smart contract in order to actually determine whether, you know, if you bet that Trump wins the election, God, I hope not, but let's just say that does happen, you need to be able to verify the real world through this Oracle that Trump did in fact win the election. So that's fundamentally what Oracles are. They're the missing link that makes smart contract platforms useful. That's how a lot of Oracle services kind of market the concept of an Oracle. So getting back to the thesis, you know, I thought that, you know, this is really interesting. They're a small team. Chainlink is obviously the big competitor in the Oracle space, but there's got to be room for second and third entrants. And when you invest really, really early, that's kind of the name of the game when you're a seed investor. You have to invest early. I mean, definitely lower than a $10 million valuation, or otherwise you're just not going to be able to get the ROI that you're really looking for as an early stage investor. So I picked them out. They're a really good team. I invested in both the token as well as something called the dev share, which means that the way their system works is that the company takes 10% of all their tokens that are mined and sells them in order to actually capitalize the business, whether it's for payroll or server costs, whatever it is, right? I purchased a percentage of that dev share so that whenever they take 10% of the tokens that are minted every 10 minutes as a result of their consensus mechanism, I take a small percentage of that as well. So the tokens, the dev share, and I invested into the equity of the company. And you don't get that type of nuance with any other company, early stage investment. There is no such thing as investing into the token of an AI company. That just doesn't exist. So there's all sorts of unique nuances that are associated with investing into the company or into a company that exists within a blockchain, within the blockchain ecosystem. Because there's no ability to invest in a token as well as equity. And obviously for early stage investing, 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100, you're investing into the equity of a company. So I know I digressed a bit there, but, so under the Ascender Ventures umbrella, I do hold a significant amount of actual tokens as well that anybody can buy. You don't have to be a accredited investor in order to invest in those types of investments. But of course do some of the equity, more accredited investor oriented investing, like investing into the equity of an early stage company as well, even if it is in the blockchain space. So, that's another example of a company I've invested in. And I also broadly speaking, to kind of wrap up my underlying thesis that's recently been crafted at Ascender Ventures, given the shift towards crypto and blockchain, what I like to do is pick out like the 3 or 4 trends that I'm most bullish in and make a bet in the one that I believe is going to just be the leader. Maybe not the one that's going to have the highest percentage gain, but the one that's going to be the stalwart in the space. So for example, when I invested in DeFi, my thesis was, okay, DeFi is going to be a thing. I originally invested in MakerDAO because MakerDAO was the underpinning for the entire DeFi ecosystem. That's shifted as there's a lot of awesome platforms that have come about to challenge MakerDAO's supremacy in the DeFi space. But that's kind of my thinking. You make thesis-oriented bets, and then you kind of back the ones that are the safest bets. Even if the bet, like the thesis itself, is still risky, like DeFi, you want to bet on the one that may not have the highest percentage gain, as I was saying, but the one that has the highest chance of success. So taking the 10x gain over the long term, instead of trying to be super alpha generating oriented and pick the one that could blow up 100x or 1000x, whatever it might be. So,
yeah, I know we're running low on time. And for anyone interested in DAOs, we talked about those with Ingemar in the first episode here. But because we have two people who are in the investor space in the Web3 area, I actually have two questions for both of you. The first is, what are you most excited about in this space? And the other one is, how do you identify value? Because you were talking about, you know, you're putting your money where you think the strongest holding will be for the long term. But how do you identify that, identify the value? And then again, what are you most excited about?
So on my side, like with about like your approach, I really like the general idea right now to basically see Bitcoin as like kind of like a digital gold, which I think especially in the current environment is like a nice nice thing to have, with like stock market going up and down and no one really knowing where it's gonna go even over like the next couple of months. Also, I definitely also like Ethereum as an investment. Like, as you said, it might be like a safe bet into the whole smart contracting idea. Because, for example, like, I was always thinking for like projects that we've also been working on, oh, why use Ethereum? Why don't we do something like faster, like with like more like usability, whatever, like why don't we choose another chain? There's so many of them out there. But eventually with two of those projects, like we started out with the idea of doing something like super, super innovative with like new chains and stuff. And we circled right back to Ethereum because you just have all the infrastructure to work on, not only the developers, but also like, for example, with DeFi, you have like all the liquidity, you have the oracles, you have the community. And for example, if you want to do something in the like STO space, you have the custodians that accept ERC20. You have the specific smart contracts that you need for certain use cases. Also, I also kind of like equity investments in like blockchain products, where I think it's like a good approach to try to find something like a product that works through blockchain, where you can basically go somewhere and like explain the product without the product basically only being blockchain. So for example, I think like in like tokenization is a really nice use case, because for example, like tokenization crowdfunding in Germany, it's like, it solves a problem because usually instead of tokens, you have brokerage accounts that are like hard to, like, it takes a while to set them up. Like it's complicated paperwork, it's legal stuff. Or like another example of where blockchain can be useful is, for example, compute to data. If there's like a factory or something where a certain part is being produced, and then you have another company using those parts that want to, for example, train their machine learning things on the data, but the producing company doesn't want to just give them the data because then they could just rebuild the factory. So with blockchain, it's like a project called, or like a project called Ocean, which can like do something like that. You can basically train your like algorithms on someone's data without like having to touch it, basically. So those, I think, are also like pretty good, interesting use cases where you're like, okay, there's like a certain problem that can now be solved through blockchain by like replacing trust system.
Yeah, I'll follow up. I mean, Flo, I basically agree with everything you just said. You know, I'm really bullish on the tokenization use case, unquestionably so. I think that you bring up a good point about Ethereum. I had mentioned the developer ecosystem, but you bring up a really good point about the infrastructure as well, right? It's like, not only do they have the people that are coding, but you have the people that have already coded, in the sense that it's like, you know, you have the centralized exchanges, you have the liquidity providers, you know, you have all the lending platforms, right? So it's like, they have the entire ecosystem built out. And I think that there's a lot of value there. So to kind of, you know, to allude to your question, Connor, about how you guys see value in this space, basically everything that Flo said, but just furthermore, I'll expand on, you know, blockchain technology is something that does minimize that trust, but it's also as a decentralized ecosystem. You can think of all the actors as basically cogs or individual entities within a blockchain ecosystem. And as those cogs multiply and as the system gets bigger and bigger and bigger, the security of that system gets much more robust. And therefore, that entire ecosystem will begin to accrue value because security is something that is such a big deal in the blockchain and crypto ecosystem. They call Bitcoin the most secure computer in the world. I'm sure Ethereum is not far behind that as one of the most secure, and it's only going to get more secure once Ethereum 2.0 comes out, which hopefully is in the next 6 months. But we'll see. There's been a lot of delays there. That's kind of how I find value in the space. It's really community oriented. And then, of course, I'm very bullish on smart contracts, generally speaking, as well. I do think that there's probably going to be some actual application specific blockchains that will get a lot of value. I think there's one, I could be wrong, I hope I don't sound stupid on here, but I think there's one called Flow Blockchain, actually, which is specifically used for the gaming space. Florian, have you heard about Flow Blockchain? Your name is Flow. Maybe you've heard about it. I don't know.
Not yet.
But in any case, there's application-specific blockchains that I think are going to really accrue a lot of value because they're built for a very specific use case. And then, of course, Ethereum will probably just be like the winner in the broad smart contract platform space. So that's kind of my thinking in the area.
Yeah. Great. I feel like that was all of my questions. Flo, do you have any more questions that you want to touch upon? I know we're over the half an hour mark that we set for ourselves, but it's been a very good conversation up to this point.
Definitely great conversation. I don't think I have any more questions on top of my head right now.
Well, I quickly just want to interject because I never fully answered the question about what the day-to-day is like at Wheelgecko. I'm not gonna go into the specifics, but I just want to let everyone know that fundamentally, my company, Emergence, we help early stage companies, specifically in the blockchain and crypto ecosystem. I mean, I would say 75% of the companies we work with are in the blockchain digital asset space. We help them seek the capital that they need to be able to then grow the business and be able to expand. So we kind of take the financing burden off of the founder's shoulders, which a lot of time founders will say the worst part about being a founder is raising capital. So my one ask, I'm not going to try to sell our services, but if you're a Series A, Series B digital asset company, I would consider looking into investment banking type of services, investment banking entities that are very friendly to the crypto and blockchain space, that know about the regulations, that understand the nuances of the space. We've seen a lot of companies benefit significantly from services like ours and some of our peers in the space. So there's a growing number of broker dealers and investment banks that are starting to get into the space. So I would just say that for people that are in that position that I mentioned, Series A, Series B, financing space, I'd be happy to have a conversation with you guys to see if it's something that I think that you guys would benefit from.
What's the best way for people to get in touch with you if they do want to reach out?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can reach out. I'll give my email address. It's richard.malone@wieldco.com. Wieldco, WEILDCO.com. Or I know Florian gave my LinkedIn, so that's a perfectly fine place to reach out. Or you can reach out in Telegram. It's at Crypto Malone.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Richard. And thank you to everyone who's listening to Satoshi's Mind at home. Again, you can find Richard on all that stuff that he just mentioned. And you can follow this show on Twitter at Satoshi's_mind. You can follow Nakamoto on Twitter at S_Nakamo_TO. And make sure you rate and review this podcast wherever you're listening. You can catch new episodes every Thursday. And one more time, thank you so much, Richard, for being on the show with us.
It was an absolute pleasure. I had such a great time.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you again, everyone listening at home.